You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs, and I'm your host, Andrew Friedman.
Here with Caitlin Friedman.
Here with Caitlin Friedman?
I don't know. Like, I'm adding
on
something.
What are you,
something.
Bob Dole? Like, I don't talking know. In the third person?
Caitlin Friedman says yes.
Okay. Well, now that sounds narcissistic.
Caitlin Friedman's a little tired, but let's keep going.
You're almost being like that sounded diva-ish.
No.
Okay.
All right, let's jump in.
So this is... I don't even know how to say this. We taped a whole intro yesterday to what was supposed to be a doubleheader. What happened was I had done an interview with Charlie Palmer, the legendary American chef Charlie Palmer, who first got famous at the River Cafe years ago and then opened Oriole and now has several restaurants on both coasts. And, you know, a day or two after I interviewed Charlie, I interviewed a chef by the name of Claire Welly. And Claire is the chef at Otway, which is a hot restaurant in Brooklyn, New York. She's at a different time of her life and career than Charlie. And I thought, for various reasons that I'll talk about in a minute, that they would make great companion interviews to each other. Both of those chefs come from sort of farmland. They have both, at different times in their lives, spent time on the different coasts. They both got best known in New York City. They were both high school athletes. They both have very specific takes on team work in a kitchen and the team mentality of a kitchen. And I thought, wow, you know, this is really interesting because Claire was born at about the time that Charlie was starting to cook in New York City. Which is an odd thing for me to say because he's not an old guy. I mean,
Charlie's not seem old at all.
He's not old at all. He's very spry. He divides his time between the coasts. He's got a million things going on. He's in his dining rooms. I mean, he is an active chef and businessman.
He still love, you know, that when you love what you do.
Yeah. But beyond that, he's just not. Although he makes a joke in the interview about his son calling him old at one point. But anyway, I thought they would make great companion pieces. And we did an intro to this twofer, and I went through and I spliced Charlie's interview and I took out the break that I had in there because there's always a break in the middle of the show, but the break was going to come between the interviews. And then I dropped Claire's interview in the second half, starting at like an hour into the episode. And her interview's so great, I thought, you know what? She was really cool. When I told her in the interview, oh, I might, you know, it's occurring to me this would be a good companion piece to Charlie, she was like, oh my God, he's a legend, and that would be cool. It wasn't okay, because, you know, people tell me all the time, if a podcast runs like 2 hours, it's too long, they don't listen, they listen on their drive to work or in the morning run, and then other things load overnight. They never get to that second hour, and I just couldn't do it. So this intro that we are now doing is the intro to the Charlie Palmer interview. But what I want people to do, and I'm doing, this is an unusual thing, and David Tatasciore, the engineer for this show, who I always thank at the end, I'm thanking him up front because I called him today and I explained the situation, and I usually deliver the show first thing Tuesday morning, like first thing for a Wednesday afternoon airing. And I said, listen, I want to drop two separate episodes on Wednesday, and I'm going to do a setup for each of them that cross-references them. So what I would love for listeners to do is to listen to this interview, and if you do subscribe, which maybe this is a way to get you to subscribe. The interview with Claire should already be in your feed. They should show up at about the same time. And I would like you to then listen to the interview with Claire Welly of Otway, because I think it's two chefs operating, you know, currently, but with very different timelines. They're of different generations. And I think it's a really interesting illustration of what's changed and also what hasn't changed. I think it's fascinating. Don't you think?
Yeah. I love the idea of the twofer, but I totally get what you're doing here.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thought Claire's deserved to stand on
its
own.
She had a lot to say.
She had a lot to say. She says it very well. Mm-hmm. And I just could not bury it in the back half of an episode. So with that said, I'm going to introduce Charlie Palmer. Charlie, again, first got known. He succeeded Larry Forgione at the legendary River Cafe. And this will be a nice way for me to do my weekly plug for my new book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession. This episode, by the way, Caitlin, this occurred to me. This is a big moment for me. People who might be checking out the show for the first time because they pre-ordered the book and see the name of the show on the flap jacket in my bio. This is one. This and the episode with Claire are the two episodes that will be at the top of the batting order if they venture into the podcast app on their phone or go to Stitcher. So anyone who's finding us that way, welcome. I hope you enjoy the show. I'm going to stop babbling in a minute. But
it's perfect that it's Charlie then, right?
Well, it's perfect that it's Charlie.
Because he's in the book.
And yeah, he's a major figure in the book.
He's got great stories there, and he's got great stories here.
Yeah, yeah. And but I also think, again, it's you know, Claire in many ways lives in this world that Charlie helped create. Mm-hmm. More than most people, she's aware of it. She talks in our interview how she listened to used to watch the Great Chef series, which originally was a PBS show. She saw it, I think she says, on A&E or Discover, something like that. So she has a lot of knowledge about the American legacies, which is great. Anyway, Charlie currently has a number of businesses on both coasts. We talk about that in the interview. We met on a weekday morning about a week ago at the top of the Archer Hotel, which is where Charlie Palmer's steak is now located. And we met up top. You could see, you could almost reach out and touch the Empire State Building. That's how close it seemed out the windows. It's a spectacular bar.
I was going to say, what upstairs. A great view.
Yeah, it was great. The restaurant proper is downstairs, but then there's a bar up at the top of the Archer Hotel. You know, Charlie, as I started to say a minute ago, he wasn't the owner. He was the chef of the River Cafe after Larry Forgione and before David Burke. That's some trio that they had at that
Amazing.
Restaurant. And then he went on and opened Oriole, originally in a townhouse in the East 60s in New York City. And then we also talk about this. He moved it a few years ago from a townhouse that he owned to a very contemporary storefront location right on the north side of 42nd Street near the Manhattan Library, near the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. And that was a big change. And we talk about, you know, being a multifaceted chef, the other businesses that he's in. We don't get too mired in the past, but I think just enough to touch on it and explain where he came from, but also very much talk about present day stuff and what he's learned as he's continued to expand and grow. And I really enjoyed how free flowing this was. And I really feel like there's an amazing sort of grace note at the end. I won't spoil it, but there was a moment to me that was almost cinematic that we get to about his life, and how circular it is in a way. And I'll just leave it at that. But to me, it was a beautiful moment. And hopefully that's enticing enough for all of you. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to start the interview with Charlie. And because I had edited out the break in the middle, and because I'm dropping a second episode today, which will have a break in the middle with an ad, this is a commercial-free
It's a very special episode.
It's a very special. I need I need like a slow sort of sentimental version of the theme song to play because it's a very special episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Okay. With that, here you go. My interview with Charlie Palmer recorded at the top of the Archer Hotel about a week ago in New York City. I hope you enjoy it. This is a great view. We are in the literally in the shadow of the Empire State Building.
I was going to say we're staring at the Empire State Building. It's kind of like in our face, but yeah, we've been here. Actually, I moved our steakhouse, Charlie Palmer Steak, from 54th Street, which we were in that location almost 3 years.
Yeah.
And moved it here to the Archer Hotel on 38th between 5th and 6th. It was last February. So we've been here just a year.
About a year.
Almost a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it? So. I mean, coming up when you did, sitting here in one of many properties of yours with a view like this up here, are there ever pinch me moments for someone like you coming up when the profession was what it was in the United States? Like, does it seem normal at this point? Or are there ever moments where you kind of go, gosh, you know, this is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's, I guess it feels very normal. But yeah. When people say to me, especially friends, you know, longtime friends or people I grew up with or even my kids sometimes say to me, he's like, you know, like Cortland the other day, we had this kind of in-depth conversation. He's our 24-year-old, you know, banker son.
Yeah.
Said to me, like, Dad, did you ever think that, you know, that when you're mature, yeah. And that's not what he said, because he said, when you're old, I said, yeah. I'm not old. First of all, let's get some straight. I'm not old. But he said, when you, did you ever think you would do all this and, you know, yeah. like be successful or, you know, from a chef standpoint. And I yeah. said, you know, I had to think about that because I don't really think in the sense of like, there was a master plan of,
no way.
You know, hey, yeah. you know, but we have always been good planners. And when I say we as a company, but also, Lisa and I as a couple and my wife, Lisa,
yeah,
we've been planners. Like we had the 10-year plan.
Did you really?
When we first got married.
When was that?
Which was, we celebrate our 25th anniversary next week.
Okay.
So, 25 years ago, we got married.
So I'm trying to do some quick math. Oriole is going to be 30.
Right.
This
so
year.
Yeah, Oriole was, yeah, like five, 6 years old.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
I had started to do, I had done, you know, we had started to branch out a little bit. We did the CC club. You know, we were looking at talking to a group in Las Vegas
yeah.
about that project at that point when we yeah. got married. But anyways, when we got married, we said in 10 years, we're going to move somewhere. And not because we wanted to move out of New York City, but it was more like I wanted to live somewhere else. And we were getting to the point where it wasn't mandatory to be in one place or another,
right.
I thought, or yeah. I felt.
You wanted to live somewhere else just
yeah, I mean,
as like
we,
part
we
of the like as part of the human
York.
Experience?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. And, you know, and I grew up in a small town, so I think, you know, part of it was, you know, I wanted not only, you know, anticipating that we would have kids.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Lisa was pregnant a year after we got married. We had our first child.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it would be great to have. And I really liked the idea of our kids growing up in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a lot of people say, oh, you moved to California because you wanted the kids to have it. That was kind of part of it. But I really think it was important that our kids grew up in Manhattan. So. So we started looking anyways, we started looking over the years, like, hey, where might this be? Where would this
right.
place, you know, this other place we might live for
yeah.
a period of time, not forever.
Uh-huh.
And, I remember we looked in Colorado, I was thinking, I don't know why, but I was thinking Montana at one point.
Yeah.
I was like, that's too far out. You know, it's like you can't get in.
Well, you just brought it up a minute ago. Yeah. You are so closely associated originally with New York City. And then
yes.
with California, but you grew yeah. up in a farming community. You grew up in Smyrna, New York.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about this for a minute? Tell me about where you grew up.
Yeah, well, I grew up in really upstate New York, you know, yeah. And I always laughed when people would say, like, that's central New York. I'm like, central New York, a half an hour, you're in Canada, for Christ's yeah. sake. You know, it's like,
from where you were.
Right. From, yeah. Right. From Smyrna.
Yeah.
But you know, Smyrna was a small is a small town. Yeah. It's I think the population now is like 268 people or
Amazing.
Something. It's less than when I lived there or yeah. grew up there.
Yeah.
But you know, we went. You know, my dad was kind of a jack of all trades. You know, part time farmer, electrician, plumber, could fix anything. That yeah. kind of person. But I lived right, so, and part of the time I lived on a dairy farm. You mm-hmm. know, I would work and live. My best buddy at that point lived on a dairy farm. So I worked on a farm. We grew hay, corn, yeah. Yeah. milked cows every morning, twice a day, which is to me the most crazy, ridiculous thing in the world. Like, you know,
what, doing it twice a day?
Know, milking cows twice a day. It's like, really? I mean, you know, when you think about that, you know, and I always laughed because when people say, oh, you know, the restaurant life is tough. No. Restaurant life is tough. Dairy farming is tough. That's you know, yeah. you can never leave them, you know, you never go on vacation. It was like, you know.
Get up at what?
Yeah, I mean, we milked them at 6 yeah. in the morning and 6 at night.
Did you
I
do
mean,
the you know. Two breakfast things? I've always been fascinated by that notion of like the first breakfast and then the second breakfast on a farm.
No. As kids, you know, we never, you know, we'd be up like 5 minutes before we had to get to milking the cows, yeah. you know, get the cows in. But for me, it was an interesting, you know, childhood. I was a big sports guy. So uh-huh. Sports,
played football,
especially football, yeah. wrestling,
was, yeah.
you know, like everybody else, you know, so that was good. And for me, I think that was, you know, really life forming in a way for me, mm-hmm. especially wrestling.
Yeah.
I always say this cause my wrestling coach was, and still is kind of a mentor to me.
Yeah.
But again,
you're still in touch.
Oh yeah. 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 I was just recently inducted into the New York State Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Is that right?
Yeah. Not because I was a tremendous wrestler. I was a good wrestler, I guess you would say, but you know, I was inducted for a humanitarian, you know.
Oh, that's so great.
Side of things. Uh-huh. And Pete Hosrath, who was my wrestling coach, yeah. is, you know, still, I talk to him, you know, I still talk to him, you know, once or twice.
Is that right? You said you used the word mentor. Is this someone you still ask for
he
advice?
He is, because he instilled in me that, you know, only you
yeah.
can be, you can create your destiny, you know, whether it's on a wrestling mat or whether it's yeah. in business, whether it's in, you know, any career that you're going to do.
Yes.
And, you know, let me tell you, after, you know, going through wrestling, it's the hardest thing I ever did in my
How so?
My
I actually,
life.
Believe it or not, I wrestled as yeah. a kid.
Because, I mean, I think it's a
I
sport.
I will not be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. No, but because it's a sport where it's you against another guy.
Yeah.
And the clock is ticking, right?
Yeah.
There's no teammates to, you know, to help you. There's nobody yes. to, you know, it's you, you know.
Can
it's
you,
like boxing. It's you against the other guy.
So right? can you speak to this for just a minute? Because
sure.
in several interviews that we've done, sports come up. The analogy of sports and the reality of sports and as a good precursor for a kitchen life has come up, right? Very
yeah.
good chefs and good leaders very often are compared to coaches and how they work with their team. That's one thing. A lot of people come to cooking and find the same appeal in early kitchen jobs that they found on high school sports teams. What doesn't come up that often, and you did both, you did football, which was a team thing, mm-hmm. is the individual sport, right? So I'm a tennis player.
Right.
I love tennis for the same reason I'm fascinated by boxing.
Right.
Right? Or for you, wrestling.
Yeah.
It is a totally, you may be on a team where your win affects other people, but being yeah. out there on your own, one-on-one, problem-solving in real time, what does that give you? What does that give you in life? What does that give you in the career you ended up pursuing?
Well, I think, I mean, the most important thing I think it gave me, and it's what I preach to our, I mean, I never refer to our restaurant groups as anything other than a team.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about, you know, they're part of our team.
Yeah.
They're team players. We have yeah. to be a team to yeah. be successful. to me, that's, you know, the restaurant business, especially like individual restaurants, if the team isn't strong, if there's a, you know, weak link in the team,
yeah,
we're not going to be as successful,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think it's building teams within each one of our restaurants is how we've built our entire company,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think, you know, from the individual aspect, the hardest thing, and I think the thing that's most important, is building a culture where every person understands that they individually have to be, you know, excellent at what they do.
Accountability.
Right. They can't. They can't lean too much on the other person.
Right.
You know, they can be supported by other team members, but you know, we have to be strong individuals to begin with.
Right.
You know, and I think you know, that goes back to the wrestling thing. You know, and accountability. I mean, I was a heavyweight wrestler, so from the team aspect of it, you'd go by weight class, right? So when a team match, it would start out the lightweights all the way up to the heavyweight. So I can't tell you how many times, and my coach sometimes wouldn't even let me be out on the mat or, you know, aside the mat.
Yeah.
I would have to stay in the locker room until my match came up.
Is that right?
Because I would get freaked out a little bit because if the team, I wouldn't know until I stepped out into the gymnasium.
Oh, wow.
Or wherever.
Yeah.
That, hey, okay, the team score is tied. If I win, team wins.
Yeah.
I lose, team loses.
Right.
You know, and I think that if the one thing that brought to me, like, yeah, it's a lot of pressure and stuff, but it was accountability. Like, I'm not winning this for me. You know, I'm not going to win my match for me. I'm going to win it because that's going to make the team win.
It's so funny. In tennis, there's this thing called the Davis Cup, this international competition.
Exactly.
And when they call the score in Davis Cup, even if you're like John McEnroe, Pete Sampras, it's, you know, 4-2 United States. They don't say your name, right? And anyone who's ever played that competition talks about what a powerful thing that is.
Yeah.
To have yourself kind of sublimated to the team.
Yeah.
That changes the whole dynamic. And there are people who perform much better in that situation, and there are people who perform worse.
Worse, yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think sports in general helped me, you know, be real about how we operate in restaurants and, you know.
Do you consider yourself competitive?
Very.
Still?
Yeah, very competitive.
That's a motivating force for you?
Yeah. I mean, I always, you know, as an individual, you know, whether it's a wrestler or whether, you know, in kitchens. When I first started in New York City, La Côte Basque, you know, it was a kitchen full of young talent that we all wanted to be the best.
Or
let's say most of us, we wanted to be the best person in the mm-hmm. kitchen. You know, we wanted to be the next sous chef.
Right.
You know, I wanted to be, you know. Yeah.
And these were your buds that you were competing against. And,
I mean, good competition, but, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I think competition's important. Like, you know, how do you gauge, you know, who you are or what you do if you don't compare yourself to, you know, your peers and stuff?
Yeah.
So.
So take me inside your life these days. You live in California, ostensibly. Your family's in California.
You know, I really, especially at this point for the last couple of years, I really split my time almost 50-50 between California and New York.
Right. You're here about what, you come here like every other week?
Pretty much every other week.
Right.
You know, my regular schedule is a week in New York and a week on the West Coast because, mm-hmm. You know, I stop frequently in Vegas,
uh-huh.
you know, and of course everything we have, you know, intentionally on the West Coast is within what I call the Bay Area, greater, mm-hmm. greater Bay Area.
Yeah. You
know? So San Francisco, you know, Napa, Sonoma.
Yeah. And how do you often get back for the weekends?
I do now. I mean, now it's changed a little bit. When the kids were in high school, when they all went to high school at Cardinal Newman in Sonoma,
mm-hmm.
I would be home pretty much a lot of the times every Friday night because it was Friday night football.
Right.
You know, and I'd be home on weekends for the game.
Yeah.
And also, you know, when the kids were off from school. So, you know, but, you know, as the kids get older too, I realized, I said to Lisa, like, you know, I'm dying and I'm getting home for the weekend to be with the kids, you know, and then once they're teenagers and dating and all that stuff, like the last thing I want to do is hang out with dad.
Correct.
And like, you know,
I have two 13-year-olds. I'm right there.
Right. You're
just happening.
You're almost at that point. You know, that, and,
so you'd be killing yourself to get back.
Exactly.
Exhausted, don't know what time it is, and no one's home.
Right. I'd be like, and they're going out there. Gotta get
it's
out
a long way like, to come to sit on a couch.
Right. I mean, you know, not that it was bad.
Watch Meet the Press.
Right. Not that it's bad because, you know, right. Healdsburg and you know, yeah. Sonoma are one of the most beautiful places.
Yeah,
you know,
it's amazing.
I could ever imagine being. So, yeah. Very lucky. But now, I mean, it really is like, you know, it's not weekend dependent. So,
right.
You know, and actually, like just recently in the last, I don't say 6 months, you know, a year, I enjoy being in New York on weekends, you know.
It's great.
Know, because,
yeah.
You know, there's just weekends in New York are different than the week, you know, yeah. During the week, you know, and I think.
And unlike in, and I feel like unlike in Northern California or in California in general because of the weather.
Yeah.
I feel like weekends in New York throughout the year, like life in New York, are they're very different experiences. Like
very
a weekend in
yeah.
the summer,
sure,
it's empty.
Yeah,
you know the streets are empty. It's yeah. It can be very pleasant. It can feel almost like a city out of time sometimes. Yeah. And then then you get into the fall and it's just pandemonium and traffic and
New York Giant football.
And it's right the whole but it is yeah. it does really change. Throughout the year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, look, we know New York is the most dynamic city in the world. I mean, I love many different places, but
right.
There's nothing like New York.
Yeah. I mean. So let's talk about Oriole for a few minutes.
Sure.
First of all, there's a momentous occasion upon us this year.
There is.
30th anniversary.
Our 30th, yeah.
Does it seem like that went fast, slow, both?
No, again, you know, I recognize that we've been very successful and, you know, knock on wood for, you know, 30 years, which is, you know, is amazing to me. But
yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't seem that long. It doesn't seem to me like, you know, 30 years. Yeah, that's a big chunk of my life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And our lives, because there's so many of us involved, you know, in Oriole, it's evolution.
Yeah.
You know, but in some ways, you know, because of, and maybe it's part of it is because we moved from the townhouse, you know, after being there 20 years,
right.
You know, over 20 years, and now moved to an incredibly dynamic space. So I think, you know, that was the second life, I call it, you know, mm-hmm. after 20 years.
Yeah.
So we're 10 years into the second life.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And, I mean, the great thing about it is we're always, and I'm a big believer, all our, you know, my wife, our staff, everybody is, you know, kind of critical of me sometimes. I'm like, I'm not concerned with the past. I'm only concerned with the future.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm a huge believer that what happened, you know, what's happened is great and, you mm-hmm. know, all that stuff. But what really is important is what we do from this day forward.
It's so funny. I had a chat early this season with Missy Robbins on this show. And the whole conversation was about not being fixated. We were talking about the past indirectly, but also, you know, I think a lot of chefs, a lot of industry people of your generation do tend to get lodged. I'm talking about a lot of our mutual friends, but kind of lodged in the past. You know, there's this resistance to the fact that things just change.
Yeah.
And I think that is the gateway to getting old. I think if you're not open to the reality, I mean, look, when you guys came up, you guys were the young punks.
Exactly.
You were though. You were the young punks that all the Francophiles were like, this isn't real. This 3 stars for this. I mean, that was the reaction to what you guys did. And I think it's so ironic that so many people who had that struggle that you guys had can't recognize that they're, you know, you can have, for example, a casual restaurant in Brooklyn and it could be great. And it's okay that people show up in shorts on Saturday night.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the most important thing. It's interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's...
But it's interesting to hear you say that, because you very easily, with all the things... I mean,
we could have stayed
with
in
all
that
the things
forever.
That you did, you could very much get wedged back there and not
People
progress.
Thought I was insane.
To leave.
Honestly. I mean, yeah, because, look, I owned the building.
Right.
Obviously, it was a great location.
Yes.
You know, 61st between Park and Madison. Yeah. We could have just stayed the course, you know, and done what we were doing and probably would still be successful. But I thought, you know, if we're going to give Oriole, you know, a chance for a longer life
yeah.
or second life, we have to do something dramatic.
Yeah.
And people, when I told people we were moving Oreo to 42nd Street, I mean, people looked at me like, okay, he's really lost it now. He's right. he's really gone off the edge.
Did they think
know?
It was like a midlife crisis thing? I mean,
some of my closest, you know, confidants and
yeah.
friends,
yeah.
you know, and people that worked with me, I mean, they really were like, maybe we should talk about, you know, maybe we should think about this. Maybe right. we should go see somebody is what they were trying to say without saying
was
it.
Was there like know? An intervention or
and
something?
And I was like, look, I think this is right. I just have a good feeling that this is yeah. right, you know, and it'll be dynamic and it'll be exciting and it'll be a chance to, you know, do something special with Oriole.
Yeah.
And
now this seems to me like a constant in your life, right? Now, can we talk yeah. about the past for just a minute? I know you don't want to sure. spend too much time there, but for people who don't know all this, you had been the chef at River Cafe.
Yes.
People forget there was a chef there before Larry Forgione. Then there was Larry.
Right.
And then you took over after a brief pause in the chef there. You yeah. became the chef.
I became the chef there. And Larry had gone already.
Had moved on. Yeah. You became the chef. Yeah. And at some point, you, this was like almost a theme of that restaurant. You, like Larry, before you, wanted to own something. Buzzy yeah. O'Keefe was not interested.
Absolutely.
And then you went yeah. forward and eventually found this home for Oriole, bought the building. And can you, but here's what I was meant about this kind of what I perceive as a real trust in your own instincts. Can you talk for a minute about the backdrop of New York City and of the financial world at the time that you were putting the finishing touches on and opening Oriole?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, like, it's probably a little bit easier because I try to think like of the younger generations and the, you know, like
yeah.
the younger chefs,
yeah.
men and women are now trying to establish themselves and start a business and things mm-hmm. like that. You know, what's different now than what was then, you know? I mean, for me personally, it was different because, you know, I was a single guy,
mm-hmm.
right? With really no one to really worry about too much. My mom and I had a little sister that I took care of. But,
yeah.
You know, it was just me. So I had nothing to lose. You know, like people would say, like, you're going to risk everything and open a restaurant on your own. Why, you know, you're making a great salary.
Yeah.
You're doing really well.
Yeah.
I said, look, I got nothing to lose.
Right.
I mean, I know how to live poor. I've been poor all my life.
Right. right.
So what's the worst case scenario? It doesn't work and I'm poor. Right.
Right.
So no big deal. You know, so that's the way it started. But, you know, when we found the building, I found the partner I thought was the right partner for me.
Yeah.
And my, you know, my direction to him was Steve Zolas and Nicola Cazzoni, who I just saw the other day.
Uh-huh. Now, this was a couple, for people who don't know, who have
yes.
Perry Ale. They had been Pina Luongo's
right.
they partners had in Il Cantinori on 10th
their,
Street
right.
in New York. Yeah.
You know, and then we opened Perry Ale together. Actually, but they had Il Cantinori at the time. That was
yeah.
that was their thing. And Steve had some real estate stuff. And anyway, so I said to Steve, "Look, we need to find a brownstone
yeah.
between 59th and 72nd, between Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue.
Yeah.
That was the direction because I wanted to create the what I termed the American Lutece.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted it in a brownstone. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to compete in that area. You know that." Part of town, I felt
mm-hmm.
like that's important.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And again, I'm sorry to yeah. keep jumping in because a lot of people don't know. Lutece was the gold standard.
Lutece was
Andre Saltner's restaurant
yes.
in New York City,
yep.
and it was the pinnacle, at least in New York,
yeah.
of French dining.
Yeah, and it was. Yeah. I don't think there's any dispute that it was considered the best French restaurant in the country. In the United States and maybe the best restaurant in the United
mm-hmm.
States, you know, from a lot of people's standpoint. So,
yeah.
you know, I wanted to be in that same arena, I guess, you know, the best
mm-hmm.
way to put it. And so we, you know, Steve found three different options, three
right.
different buildings. We decided on this one, bought the building.
Yeah.
It was a complete shambles and, you know, tore it down, gutted it from, you know, inside and out, dug out the basement. There was no basement in the back part of the building. We dug out the basement and created a, you know, kitchen space in the basement area.
Mm-hmm.
And
who was doing this work?
Well, I was doing, I became, I had this crazy notion. I wanted to be the general contractor. So, mm-hmm. you know, we were probably not the best idea now that I think back, but, yeah. But anyways, it worked.
But who's and, we? It was you and your...
Well, it was really me. I was the general contractor. Steve and I hired all the subcontractors. Uh-huh. We worked, obviously, with an architect to, right. to put the whole thing together. But, you know, as we were finishing and finally getting the restaurant ready to open and the building, redid yeah. the whole building, you know, it was 1987. You know, it was Black Monday,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I can't tell you how many people drop by to tell me, wow, this is a great idea, opening a high-end restaurant, maybe in the worst economy in 25 years, right? Yeah. Like, you know, they were like, oh, thanks a lot, guys. You know, right. really wishing me well.
Right,
know?
Right.
But what was I going to do? Look, again, I had nothing to lose.
But you did have you something. Know? I mean, I don't mean to, but you, see, this yeah. is what's so interesting to me because you are, you know, even when I think of you and I was starting to be around the scene back then, I was yeah. in New York anyway. I was a student in the late 80s. But I, you know, I remember yeah. seeing you in, you know, in photographs and the paper and New York Magazine. Yeah. And, you know, I really think of you as a New York City person, but it does seem, and you just talked about it a minute ago, I feel like yeah. the strength that you had from growing up the way you did, it seems to me like that's something that's never left you. Like when you said yeah. a minute ago, you knew how to live poor. I mean, you yeah. did have something to lose, but you were willing to lose it and you weren't scared of losing it.
No, I've never been, you know, some people say I'm a big risk taker, but I think it's calculated risk at yeah. least, you know, like, and if you have confidence, I mean, I think the one thing that's made not only me, but our whole group successful is, you know, if we are failing at something, we figure it out. We figure out yeah. how to, you know, how to make it successful or how to make success out of it. And, you know, I think that's a good trait to have because, you know, it's all great when everything's going well and yeah. everything's, you know, successful. But, you know, it's those hard times when, yeah. you know, you have to hunker down and say, mm-hmm. okay, let's figure this out. We're smart people. We have a smart group. We're the hardest working people in the business. We'll figure this out.
Yeah.
And we've done that, I don't know, how many times, you know, yeah. many, many times.
Yeah. Before we move on yep. and get back to the present day, can you just tell people what Sheetrock dinners were?
Sheetrock dinners. Well, Sheetrock dinners at the townhouse, what I call Oriel, the original building, yeah. the townhouse. Sheetrock dinners were a bit of frustration because, you know, because I was the GC and because I'm a chef, of course, the kitchen was complete way before everything else. And,
yeah.
and you know, construction people worked till 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And pretty much every day, once the kitchen was ready, I had a small core of people in the, you know, working. Starting up the kitchen, totally illegal, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And we would clean up, you know, sweep up the dining room, you know, all the sheetrock dust, throw down a table, and literally cook and invite people in and, you know, have these what we called the sheetrock dinners. You mm-hmm. know,
but invite, you know, people in from where?
Some off the street.
Right.
I mean, literally, we had a lot of construction workers because my theory was, like, the nicer we are to these people, the faster we're going to get done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was true to an extent.
You know? Yeah.
So, yeah, sheetrock dinners were fun. You know, and we would bring in every wine salesman we could figure that was somehow going to give us some samples because
right.
you know,
like, right.
that was the wine, right?
Right.
yeah. Sheetrock dinners are fun. yeah. But everybody leave, their pants were, you know, their clothes were covered with sheetrock dinners uh-huh. because the whole place was a mess, you know?
Okay. So what's the anniversary is coming up.
Yes.
What yeah. is there anything happening for that?
Yeah. I'd like to, honestly, I haven't confirmed it yet, but I'm trying to get Georges Blanc to come cook with me at Oriel.
Wow.
And, you know, Georges Blanc, I worked at Georges Blanc when I was young, and I just found him to be, again, a mentor type person because what he's done with in his realm, you know,
yes.
in Bonnat, you know, he's got the main restaurant and hotel, and then he's got a bistro.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's got, what, 5 or 6 bistros. He's got a winery.
Mm-hmm.
He owns, you know, the florist across, he's got
right.
a butcher shirt. You know, he did all these things that, you know, I like that idea and I've kind of followed in some ways.
Yeah.
I like to do, and a lot of us have done.
This was a big kind of North Star, not just him, but a lot of these
yeah.
chefs who they were in a town outside the city.
Yes.
These are the people, there's a book called The Great Chefs of France.
Yeah.
which came out, I think, in 78.
I was going to say, yeah.
And it was very pointedly, it was the profiles of all the three-star Michelin chefs outside Paris.
Right.
And a lot of these people, they were the destination for their towns. And they also, in a lot of ways, own the towns. Like,
absolutely.
You know, you just mentioned Blanc. Like, he was not the only one, though.
Vonnaz, which is the town that Georges Blanc is based in, because he has other things around it now. But you know, once you enter the town proper, you can tell. I mean, like, the flowers, the way the streets look, everything about this small town has got Georges Blanc written all over it.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting and unique. Some people would say, oh, you know, he took over a town. But to me, it's like he's made it just in a magical, beautiful, wonderful, delicious place.
Yeah, know? But this was also again, this is one of these things people take for granted now, but you guys, the guys who came up when you did, this was a real sort of revelation that you guys are here just kind of trying to, learn how to make a consomme, get through the day, you know, not get yelled at, get 3 hours of sleep. It all seemed very kind of physical and urgent and stressful.
Yeah.
But these guys, there was this sort of pot of gold. I don't mean money-wise, but there was this sort of thing that started to come into focus as chefdom, as potential beyond what you could have ever imagined as a, you know, when you first took like your home ec class as a kid.
Exactly. And it was somebody,
it was like, aspirational.
Like Georges Blanc, you look at somebody like that and I certainly realize there's a bigger picture here. Right.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And that's why, you know, I was like, look, when I was the chef at the River Cafe, the next step for me was to own my restaurant. Yeah. Right.
And that
and
came from
real estate.
And that came from
Georges
Blanc
idea.
And his
not just
peers.
Georges Blanc, but it was like, that's like, why not?
Yeah.
That's what we should. If you're going to work this hard.
Right. Yeah. So Charlie, there's an event that I've never been to that you do on the West Coast called Pigs and Pinot. Can you tell me about this? The genesis of this and what it's become over the years? It's something every year some friend of mine, maybe Michael White's been out a couple of times, I think.
Yeah.
But people have said to me, are you coming? And I always think, I'm going to go this year. I've never gone. But tell me about this thing.
Well, Pigs and Pinot, ever since living in, for part of my life, I should say, living in Healdsburg and becoming, it was always my dream as a chef to become also a vintner and, you know, I've been able to realize that because we grow Pinot Noir on our property, 4 different varieties, varietals, I should say different rootstock. And anyways, we make Pinot Noir with a good friend of mine, Clay Moritzen, and Pigs and Pinot came about because of a local school charity, a school in our town where our kids were going to school, wanted to raise some money to build a library.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, is there anything you can do? I said, well, let's throw a dinner. You know, we'll raise some money. I'll throw a dinner. We'll get some winemakers together. We'll throw a dinner.
Yeah.
We'll raise some money for the school. Well, so, you know, after thinking about it for a while, I said, well, let's come up with a theme for this that, you know, will make it attractive and, you know, people will think it's a cool thing. So I said, you know, I always love the pairing of Pinot Noir with pork because I think it's one of those things where it's really natural and, you know, the really upfront fruit and the acidity in Pinot Noir in general.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of different Pinot Noirs, obviously. And pork, you know, the saltiness, all the things you associate with pork.
Yeah.
You know, smoky bacon or, you know, saltiness, cured hams.
Right.
You know, prosciutto, whatever it may be. So I said, let's, you know, and after banging around for a while, I came up with this Pigs and Pinot. It's Pigs and Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a great pairing. So we did the first dinner. We, you know, it was very successful. We invited some, you know, people that I knew loved Pinot Noir, especially. Yeah. And, you know, so the first year it started like that. And next year it got a little bit bigger. And then, you know, it was really probably into year 3 of it, or 3 or 4, that I said, let's make this a bigger event. And so, you know, what it is now is really a celebration of pork and Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Takes place at Hotel Healdsburg and Dry Creek Kitchen, which is our, you know, right on the town square in Healdsburg.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's now it's become, it's evolved a little bit. It's become like a 2-day event. It's really a lot of fun, and it's very casual. It's very, it's not formal at all. It's,
yeah,
you know, the first night it's a walk around. It's about 500 people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have, with the guest chefs and other chefs, we have 40 different dishes, pork mm-hmm. dishes, 60 different Pinot Noirs that people can taste. And
yeah.
And it's become kind of a really, the competition has become very important, I think, to vintners and winemakers, because to win the Pinot Cup, which is what it's called, we have a panel of at least 3 wine writers and 1 or 2 master sommeliers that blind taste these 60 Pinots and choose. So the Pinot and the runner up, we've put Pinots on the map that people have never heard of. Like, you know, last we had a McNulty one. I mean, McNulty makes 300 cases of wine.
Yeah.
Very interesting, you know, yeah. small producer.
Yeah.
To, you know, like a Tom Rocchioli, who's like, to me, the benchmark of Pinot Noir and the mm-hmm. Russian River, you mm-hmm. know, things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's very interesting and component. And then we do like a little kind of Iron Chef competition the next day that's limited to an audience of 50 people.
Right.
Mario Cantone is our MC, so it's really fun and, you know, and very raucous.
Yeah. Well, that's appropriate because yeah. he knows how to ham it up.
Yeah. And he's a big food and wine lover. So that's great. And then we have the Pinot Smackdown, which is 4 master sommeliers.
Yeah.
That choose 4 different Pinot Noirs, and it's yeah. kind of like a March Madness, you know, yeah, yeah. bracket thing.
Yeah,
the 100 guests, you know, walk through what would be, you know, the equivalent of a tasting that the master sommeliers would do, or you know, yeah, sommelier, yeah. you know, people would,
wow.
would work at. So
this is huge.
It's a lot of fun, and, then
and
we
it's
have
in
a,
it's know, in March. Yeah,
it's always the third weekend of March.
Okay, you know? That's yeah. fun. Oh, one of these days. So you talked about having a 10-year plan years ago.
Yeah.
What at this point, with everything you've got, with everything you've done, what gets you excited these days? Looking forward, what's
our 10-year plan?
Well, I don't know if you have a 10-year plan at this point, but what's still like what's unfinished business for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think we're in a very fortunate position because we don't have to do anything, you know. I'm not beholden to a public company. I'm not, you know, no one's telling me you have to do this or whatever. Yeah. So that's a really great position to be in because
yes.
going forward, first of all, I want to do things that I'm interested in that really get me excited.
Yeah.
You know, like whether it's another restaurant yeah. or another business, because we've delved into the wine business. And I think I really love the whole wine aspect of what we do globally, but also I love the idea of growing grapes and making wine and, you know, and being successful at that yeah. and doing it with people that I really enjoy.
Is it also just yeah. the learning something new, learning a new business?
Is, yeah.
You enjoy
yeah,
that still.
I've learned a tremendous amount about winemaking. I don't pretend to be a winemaker at all.
Right. But I mean, taking yeah. it apart from the fact that it's connected to food, that it's wine, that but
it's
just the fact of learning, taking something new on, studying yeah. it, mastering it, being successful at it,
exactly.
you take satisfaction in that.
Yep.
So there may be something
and
like...
I love farming. I mean, I think, you know, look, the most important thing any true vintner will tell you, you know, great wine happens in the vineyard.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's really true. It's about growing grapes.
Yeah.
So I love the idea that, you know, I know a lot more about growing grapes than I did 10 years ago, and
right.
I'll know a lot more 5 years from now.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to me. And I think, you know, I love the hospitality business, you know, not just restaurants, and that's something that we've grown in, you know, with hotels.
Yeah.
And that's where I think our efforts will be is to grow our hotel properties.
Yes.
You know, maybe... You know, I'd love to have a collection or, you know, comprised of a number of specifically wine country hotel
uh-huh.
properties.
Uh-huh.
Because I think there's, again, it's, you know, wine country, the sensibility about being in wine country and wine countries all over the world, but,
yeah.
you know, specifically Napa and Sonoma.
Yeah.
It's just magical, you know, and it's a great counterpoint to New York City for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love New York City. I will always have a home in New York.
Yeah.
I will always be, you know, tied to New York and,
yeah.
and have that, you know, that base. But the wine country is just magical. And, And I don't know. And in the hospitality business, again, it's a business we are still growing and understanding and, you know, learning.
Yeah.
But when you think of it globally, it's hospitality. Whether, you know, someone's coming into your restaurant and enjoying a great meal and a glass of wine or whatever it may be, or an incredible cocktail, or they're, you know, entering a room and how they feel.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, creating comfort and creating a sensibility that, you know, people are like, wow, they've been transported to a place they really like, you know?
Yeah. Do you connect your roots, no pun intended, where you grew up, to your affinity for wine country? You know, you were just talking about, you know, the grapes are grown and, you know, you're talking about farming.
Yeah.
Do you connect
I've always been an outdoorsman.
Is there someone in there, you know, again, I always think of you as a New Yorker who went west, but you also went kind of back to the land a little bit.
Like,
is that accurate? Are there times in the morning out there where you kind of, where you're connected to sort of this kid from upstate New York?
I'll run into vineyards. You know, I run, you know, like, you know, get some exercise, run into vineyards.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's nothing like it. You know, it's like things are growing, you know, it's
right.
And it's not unlike when I was a kid, you know, we had great vegetable gardens when I was a kid. And at the time, we grew vegetables because they were cheap.
Yeah.
You know, that's sure. Then we had food to eat. You know, I didn't think of it that way then.
Right.
But we always had great vegetable gardens. And of course, you know, we grew corn and hay and, you know, to feed the cows and that kind of thing. But it's not a lot different. It's just a different way of looking at it, like growing grapes and growing all kinds of, you know, fruit and vegetables, you know, in Sonoma.
Yeah.
And raising, you know, and raising animals. We don't have any animals yet, but I'm thinking.
Yet.
I want to raise some beef cattle, you know, and I think, again, but that's kind of getting really back to the, you know.
But this also takes it all the way full circle in some ways.
Yeah. But I think that's cool to be able to, you know, raise animals, grow whatever we're growing, you know, kind of be, you know, all encompassing.
Yeah.
Know?
Great. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Great talking to you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate having me. Yeah.
Thanks for making the time. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Are you like me? Did you love that moment at the end where Charlie talks about jogging through the vineyards? Charlie, who grew up in the small dairy community of Smyrna, New York, back at this point in his life, running through the vineyards of Northern California. I just thought that was so great. Maybe it's just me, but I love that. I love the way that kind of brought his life full circle. Anyway, that is our show for this week. Thank you to Charlie Palmer for making time to talk to us. Also, Charlie, thanks for all the time you gave me in the book. You haven't seen it yet, but there's a lot of ink about you in there, and I hope you enjoy it. And if you would like to follow this show, you can do that on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. The handle is @ChefPodcast. And if you would like to subscribe to the show, it is free. And you can do that at Stitcher and iTunes. And if you would leave us a rating or especially a review at Apple's iTunes store, it does help people find the show, and we would really appreciate it. That's it for this week. Please go listen to the companion interview with Claire Welly. Should be the next interview up in the queue if you are a subscriber. And we will see you back soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Thanks for listening.